You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Snap Judgment, tonight at 7, we'll hear stories that take us to the brink. It's not just one thing, it's several things back-to-back that leave you in a place you never expected to be. Tonight after 7 on Snap Judgment here on the Ideas Network. First, the middle class is frequently brought up in campaign speeches and political platforms as a way to appeal to a broad spectrum of the American public.
I met with high school and college students in New York and Pennsylvania to discuss the surest path to the middle class, some form of higher education.
Good paying jobs are the ticket to the middle class, and we're going to stand up for the American middle class again.
We have a middle class which for the last 40 years has been disappearing, and we have massive levels of income and wealth inequality that we have got to address.
While reaching the middle class is a big part of achieving the American dream, it isn't what it used to be. Stagnant wages, increasing college tuition rates, growing debt have made the middle class dream less of a sure thing for many Americans. And recent studies find many middle class Americans don't have money to deal with a sudden financial emergency. Our next guest says that's him. Joining us to talk about this all is Neil Gabler. He's a writer and a visiting professor in the MFA Creative Writing and Literature program at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. He's gotten a lot of response to his recent piece in The Atlantic titled The Secret Shame of Middle Class Americans. Neil, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Well, what led you to write this piece looking at what you call the secret shame, the money troubles facing middle class America?
Well, I wrote it not because I like to expose my own foibles. In fact, if you know my writing, and not that anyone should, but I never write about myself. But when I read a news item last year from a Federal Reserve survey of household economics, they asked people if they had a $400 emergency, would they be able to meet that emergency? And 47% of the respondents said that they could not do so without either borrowing money or selling something. Now, I found that astonishing that there was 47%, nearly half of the American people, couldn't afford $400. But I knew I was in that 47%. And so I decided, perhaps against my better judgment, that I would put a face on that statistic. And I would come out from my hiding place, and I would be that face. And I coined a term in this article, financial impotence, because like sexual impotence, it's, you know, your financial difficulties are not something that anyone ever wants to talk about, even to their closest friends, and in some cases, even to the members of their family. So I wanted to overcome that sense of financial impotence, and I hope help others.
Yeah, you actually quote somebody, an acquaintance of yours in the piece, saying something like, I'd tell somebody I was taking Viagra before I told somebody I was having money troubles.
That's right, and I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we'll talk about our sexual difficulties before we'll talk about our financial difficulties, because financial failure in this country is regarded as a disease. You know, we are a country of winners and losers. We have one presidential candidate who divides the entire world into winners and losers, but he's not the only one. We're almost inculcated to think that way, and no one wants to be on the losing side of that divide. And to be on the losing side of that divide, given the fact that we measure success in America almost exclusively by money, is to have financial difficulties, or what economists call financial fragility or financial distress. The surprising thing is that so many people are victims of financial fragility and financial distress. Nearly half of Americans, and those are the ones who actually talk about it, because of financial impotence, it may even be larger than that. And the thing, Rob, is that, you know, and I include myself certainly in this, you know, poor people are by definition struggling. But financial impotence is something that strikes across almost every demographic cohort. Male and female, young and old, and frankly, rich and poor. There's one study that I cite in my article that says that of people who make between $100,000 and $150,000 a year, they could not afford a $2,000 emergency in a month's time. They couldn't raise that money. One quarter of them could not. One quarter. So this is something that strikes, you know, virtually everyone. I call it an equal opportunity malady.
And Neil, this is one of those things where it seems like people are dealing with this on an individual basis. Where do things go wrong for me? What did I do wrong? What happened to me? And yet it's happening to a lot of people. Do you think that we think of this as an individual problem instead of a society-wide problem because of this silence about it?
Absolutely, Rob. I think a function of two things, and they're very closely related. Yes, we are silent, and so we don't know that this is going on. And I'll tell you I've been getting a lot of emails of people who've hunted for my email. It's not publicly available, and they've written me their stories. The one that I found in some ways the most touching, because it was the most succinct, was, thank you, thank you, thank you. Now I know I'm not alone. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is that in America, we are taught that we are personally responsible for everything. And by the way, this is not true of every industrialized country. This is something that's pretty exclusive to America. If you look at surveys in other countries, Germany and France and England, where people are suffering from economic distress, and ask them, is this totally your responsibility? Is it totally on you? They will say it's not totally on them. There are other external forces. But in America, we have come to believe, we've been taught to believe, we've been brainwashed, you might say, to believe that if we have trouble, it's all on us. It's all our fault. In America, anyone can succeed if you work hard. Well, I'm going to tell you something. You know, I work very hard, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and I have a difficult time making ends meet. And the people who wrote me, to a person, a man and a woman, they tell me how hard they work and how difficult it is. And no one is going to tell me that 50% of the American people are lazy, and that's the reason why they have financial difficulties. It just doesn't compute. It doesn't make any sense.
Talking to writer Neil Gabler about his piece in The Atlantic titled The Secret Shame of Middle-Class Americans. He says a lot of people dealing with what he calls financial impotence, inability to react to an emergency financial situation. A lot of people not talking about it. Neil, you talk about the hard work, the responsibility. Yet in this piece, you really put your foibles out there. You do say some of it is on you. Could you talk about that a little?
Oh, absolutely, Rob. Look, I don't want to lay this off on all sorts of, you know, outside forces and disclaim any responsibility for what happened to me. And I don't think most people want to do that. I am responsible in large measure to the things that happened to me. I lived beyond my means. But one of the reasons I live beyond my means, as I make absolutely clear in the article, and I think a lot of people can sympathize with this, is that my means were constantly diminishing. You know, wages in America have been stagnant since 1972. And if you think this is just a matter of not being able to access the money from a bank account to meet an emergency, net worth, which includes, you know, all of our assets, has also declined dramatically. The median net worth in America between 2003 and 2013 declined 38%. So, you know, it's on me. You know, I've made mistakes. I lived beyond my means. I made choices. I made choices to become a writer. I made a choice to live in New York City. I made a choice to have two children. When they were young, I made a choice to send them to private school. Later on, I sent them to public school. But I made that choice because we lived in New York and the public schools were not good where we lived. You know, I made a whole series of choices without thinking through fully the economic consequences of those choices. But I think, like most people, we make life choices because we're living. You know, these are the choices that define who we are. We don't make those choices because we're based on economic circumstance. Most of the time we make choices because, you know, I didn't choose to become a writer because I was thinking, gosh, I know I'm going to have a difficult time economically, or I'm going to have an easy time economically. I chose to become a writer because it was something that I was moved to do. I didn't choose to live in New York because I just love New York. I chose to live in New York because I thought it would be good to be close to magazines and publishers. And we could go down the list of the decisions that I made and the decisions that they make in their lives. And we do pay the price when we make wrong decisions. I paid the price, and it's on me. It's on me. I am not absolving myself of any responsibility. On the other hand, it's not all on me, and particularly for your listeners who are in similar circumstances, it's not all on them either. When people lost their jobs in the Great Recession, I get a number of emails like that. That wasn't all on them. They didn't ask the housing bubble to burst. They didn't do that. So, you know, it's a mixture. It's a mixture of personal responsibility and social responsibility.
We're talking to Neil Gabler. He's a visiting professor at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. He wrote the piece we're talking about, The Secret Shame of Middle-Class Americans, for The Atlantic. We're talking about the financial struggles facing people around the country, including himself. Almost half of Americans surveyed said, hey, if there's a $400 financial emergency, they don't have it. They don't have that $400. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Are you struggling financially? Or have you been able to create a safety net for you and your family? If you were faced with this $400 emergency, would you be able to meet it? And is this idea that things are going to get better, things will be better for your kids than the previous generation, are you not feeling confident about that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the financial struggles facing the American middle class and the pervasive nature of hiding financial issues in order to keep up appearances. We want to hear from you. Is this you? Are you in the middle class, but you don't have money to meet even a small, say, $400 financial emergency? Is this something that you just haven't talked about? You don't feel like you can talk about with people? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Neil Gabler is with us. His piece is linked on our Facebook page. It's called The Secret Shame of Middle Class Americans. And we'll go to our callers now. Jim starts us off in northern Wisconsin. Jim, hi.
Hi. My point is, I graduated from high school in 1979 from a technical trade high school in Milwaukee. I was offered a job at $19 an hour. I didn't take it. I went on to college. I now am a state worker. I needed a college degree for the present job I have. I make $24.50 an hour. So I agree with this guest 100% that the middle class is just really being squeezed out of a comfortable living.
Jim, thanks for the call. Neil?
Jim is absolutely right. Let me cite another statistic that I cite in the piece. It was a survey that was conducted by USA Today in 2013. And what they asked was, what would it cost to live a middle-class existence, a yearly cost of a middle-class existence, which they defined as the way that many of us would define a middle-class existence, a $250,000 home and an automobile and sending our kids to college, not necessarily to pricey private schools, but to college, you know, to have a yearly vacation, to meet our health costs. I mean, these are sort of all the metrics that we use when we measure middle-class existence. What they discovered when they leveled this out geographically, because obviously middle class is a lot more expensive in, say, New York City than it is in the Midwest, it would cost $130,000. Only one in eight Americans makes $130,000. So what does that tell you? It tells you that what we'd always regarded as a middle-class life is unavailable now to most of us, myself included. So this is an issue that, I think it statistically, the macroeconomic picture is bright. You know, unemployment is down. The economy is growing. But the microeconomic picture in our day-to-day lives is nowhere near as bright. By one of the studies that I cite in my piece, 76% of Americans say they're living from paycheck to paycheck. From paycheck to paycheck.
Jim, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Paul in Lake Geneva. Paul, hi.
Hi, yes. I've been a marketing graphic design consultant for probably 25 years, and worked in Minneapolis, Los Angeles, now in this area, northern Illinois. And since 2007, the work has gotten harder to come by because of, I think, technology, and also some of the work that I do has been brought in-house. So it's harder to come by, but also when we do get to work, we had to make a big price adjust after 2007, in fact, lowering the hourly rate. So it's there's a lot of people in my line of work, consulting, where just to get the job now, you have to come in much, much lower, or you won't get the work. And in addition to that, I'm, you know, after giving my daughter tens of thousands of dollars for college. She's also a writer now, and I have to make her student loan payment. So, yeah, I could come up with $400, but I'm going to have to borrow it.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Paul, if he's talking about freelancing and consulting. We hear a lot, Neil, about the gig economy where, you know, you do a job when it's needed, and that's even harder to make ends meet in some ways as things are going, Neil.
And you don't get benefits. You know, Paul is absolutely right. Now, I'm a writer, and I'm a relatively successful writer. I've been doing this for many, many years, and I get a lot of work. You know, I don't have that many fallow periods. Last year, I wrote 30 articles, including some major, you know, profiles, and I wrote a book. But Paul is absolutely right. I'm making less money now for an article than I made 20 years ago. Less money than I made 20 years ago. So the gig economy doesn't help any of us when we're struggling and there's so many people who are now a part of it. And the other thing that he referenced is paying for your children's education. Education gets more and more and more expensive. And one of the things I talk about in the piece is I wanted to give my daughters the education that they wanted. I didn't want to force them into an education that I could afford. And I needed my parents to help me out, frankly. And I gave them a good education. One of them went to Stanford, and the other went to Emory in Georgia. But that wipes you out. And in my case, it not only wiped me out, but it wiped out whatever money I would have inherited from my parents. And I hear again and again and again, particularly after I've written this article, from parents who tell me the same story. You know, college wipes us out. And I've said in my piece, I say, I'm not going to say that universities are extortionists, and I have to be careful what I'm saying when I'm talking to people in Madison at the University of Wisconsin, but universities are extortionists. You know, it's so hard to afford a college education. One of the colleges to which I sent my daughters told me that if I could afford to pay my mortgage, then I could afford to pay for her education, full freight.
Talking to Neil Gabler, he wrote The Secret Shame of Middle-Class Americans, talking about financial impotence spreading to the middle class, people having trouble making ends meet, meeting financial emergencies, paying mortgages, and college tuition. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Mary is on the line in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just would like to share the fact that people don't share their financial means, and when my mom passed away, we definitely got an eye-opener to see how much in debt my parents were. But my husband and I, looking at my family, I do disagree with the fact that people are put in these positions. I really think it comes down to the choices that we make on how we spend our money. Because as we looked at my parents, they definitely could have spent their money much differently and not been in the situation they are. And I see it with my two sisters. They're in the same, they're not doing well off financially, but when we look at how they spend their money, they're just not making very good choices, and they tend to buy things for the moment, the things they want, as opposed to thinking about their future and the things they need.
Mary, thanks for the call. Neil, agreeing with you about the silence, but thinking it's kind of more on people and their personal choices.
Well, I think Mary is right that, I mean, you know, certainly we make choices, and I describe some of mine, and there is an element, and it's a large element, of personal responsibility. On the other hand, we're not responsible for the fact that our wages have been stagnant since 1972, and that's something that we have no control over. So, you know, it's a combination of factors. We do, of necessity, I believe, have to downsize our notion of the American dream. You know, we can't be told that we can have it all, because we can't have it all. All we have to do is work hard, and we're going to have it all. Because, as I said earlier, people work very hard. I work very hard. Most of the respondents I got to my article work very hard, and they can't have it all. So, you know, it's a combination of factors. There is an element of personal responsibility. But I live very frugally. We don't go out to eat. I seldom go to movies, even though I was a film critic. We never go on vacation. And when I say never, I mean, I can't remember. It's been at least a decade and probably longer since my wife and I have been on vacation. That just doesn't happen. As I say in the article, I drive a 1997, you know, Toyota Avalon that I inherited from my father that has 160,000 miles. I couldn't live any more frugally. But here's what Mary didn't reference. Emergencies. Because we live within an emergency. 60% of Americans, according to a Pew survey that I cite in my article, say that they suffered some major loss in the previous year. The loss of a spouse, the loss of a job, a medical emergency, whatever it is. You know, these are things that visit, that get visited upon us, that rain upon us, and we all live within calamity.
We'll leave it there. Neil Gabler has been talking to us. He's a writer, visiting professor at the University of New York, Stony Brook. His piece, The Secret Shame of Middle Class Americans, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.